Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at weather and climate next with our weather guys. We'll talk about the effects of the summer solstice or what it may have on our weather with John Martin, a professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. John, great to have you back.
Great to be back, Larry. Thanks.
And Steve Ackerman. Steve is the director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the UW, and also, of course, a member of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, great to have you back.
It's great to be back again, the last Monday of the month.
Yep. The last Monday of the month. And tell you what, if you have a question for these guys or maybe a comment, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question, or if you've got a great weather photo, we always love those, and we get some good ones every single time they're on. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. That's the title of our page. And, well, what about summer solstice? Does that have an effect on our weather? How does it affect our weather?
Yeah, so it's the way we think of summer solstice being on June 20 or 21st. This year it was on the 20th.
I think it was the 20th. It was one of the earlier ones. Yeah,
yeah. It's when the when there's basically 12 hours everywhere on the planet.
No. Longest day of the year.
Longest day of the year. Oh yeah, I got that mixed up totally. So John, tell us about the summer solstice.
No. You just said the wrong thing. Go ahead.
It's when the sun reaches its highest point north.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
For us, in the northern hemisphere, 23.5 degrees.
It's the longest day of the year.
For us, right?
And there's several days right at that point where there's the longest day of the year. And I think we just maybe had the last couple of those this weekend, and now they're going to. If you were really keeping a stopwatch, you'd start to notice a little bit of a change the next couple of weeks. And then a greater change in late July and August.
Yeah, and Ann and I were just the other day driving at coming back at night, like at 8:30, and all of a sudden it seems like it's getting darker.
Yeah,
you know, and Ann had noticed that because boy, it just seems like it was like 9 o'clock just a couple of days ago.
I had the opposite experience last night. We kind of both were tired at the end of the weekend. Did a lot of things, various things, and it was 9:30. And we were turning the lights off to go to bed, and I look out the window, and the horizon is still a little bit bright. I thought, oh, my God, what are we doing? It's 9:30. It's still light out.
But I think the other thing for us was that the 2 weeks ago we were in Paris, and Paris is at, like, 55 north or something.
Yeah.
So there,
it doesn't get dark
until after 10 p.m. In the summertime. It's just crazy.
That's a big difference.
But so it's astronomical, but
doesn't really have an effect on the weather.
Yeah, not really. So we have the standard summer months in meteorology, which is June, July, and August.
Yeah.
We've talked about previously how you can define the first day of winter meteorologically when the chance of precipitation being frozen is greater than 50%.
Yeah. Right?
That's a kind of a good way to...
Is that the winter solstice? That's not the winter solstice.
No. It's just a...
Just a broad characterization of the season. But the one that we were thinking about this spring in the article in the State Journal was looking at all the calendar days. On what days has there been a record high of 90 degrees or higher in Madison? I think it spans from May 24th to September 22nd or something in an unbroken string. So to me, that's the definition of summer. You know, even though it starts, that definition starts a month before the solstice.
Yeah.
And ends about, well, long.
I don't want to give up spring, though.
Yeah, I know. I'm just throwing it out there because you're right. The ones for the winter are a little bit more numerous. You know, people have various ones. The snow probability versus rain or number of days where the temperature gets below 20 overnight or something. It's not as common for the summer. And the summer solstice stands alone as sort of this thing that it happens. People seem to celebrate it, but it doesn't really have a great impact on the weather as an event itself.
What's the winter solstice again?
So that's when the sun makes its furthest trek south.
Yeah, okay. So that's our shortest day of the year.
Yeah. Okay. The one none of us like.
The one. Yeah. Well, we like it because it means it's going to start getting more sunlight.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
The next day. We like the day after the winter solstice.
Yeah, that's right. That's the rusty lining of the summer solstice is that, oh, no, it means the days are getting shorter already.
Well, here's Randy in Milwaukee with a question. Randy, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you. I love hearing you guys on the last Monday of every month. I look forward to it.
Oh, thanks.
I wanted to ask about the... In Milwaukee, we've been having several, I think, three nights of a sort of pinkish, orangish, reddish sky that fills the sky. It wasn't just on the horizon. It wasn't just at the sunset. It fills the sky, I would say, two or three weeks ago or maybe a month ago.
Yeah.
Are you aware of it?
Yeah, we've seen
understand what that is?
We've seen a few like that around here, too, and not so far in the past, even quite recently. But I think it has to do something with the fact that when the sun's going down, we're going to see more of the longer wavelengths of light anyway, even if there's no clouds in the sky. But if on top of that you've got kind of a low cloud deck, or even when it's a middle cloud deck that's nearer the horizon side of the sky, the western horizon than the eastern horizon, you get reflection of that orangey red light off the base of the clouds, and it extends the distance across the sky at which those colors seem to pervade. So that's the thing that I've noticed that I think jives with what you're saying. It might not be the same thing that you've seen, but that's really dramatic and sometimes absolutely spectacular. The half the sky or more can be orange for, you know, half an hour or something. It's really something.
That's exactly what I saw.
Yeah,
I had never seen it before, so I was pretty impressed. And I could imagine in the old days, you would certainly think the end of the world was coming if you saw that red sky.
Yeah, and I'll ask you this. Had it rained on the day that you saw the most vivid example?
Honestly, I can't remember.
Yeah,
damp. I think it was...
Damp?
Humid.
Yeah, humid. In my recollection, it's never been one of those days where it's poured rain, but it's been a day where there's been a little bit of rain right near sunset, and that makes the clouds have a lower ceiling, they call it, where when you first hit the bottom of the cloud, it's kind of a lower elevation. That helps with the reflection of that color.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And that reminds me, and we've talked about this in the past, the old red sky in the morning, sailor take warning.
Red sky night, sailor takes...
delight.
Yeah.
Red sky morning, sailor take warning.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Red sky night, sailor's delight. Yeah.
And there's a little bit of truth to that, I guess.
I think there is. I mean, we have different... I think you've had an explanation that you found in a book that's different from the one that I'd always heard, but they both make sense.
Yeah, to me, red sky in morning, sailor takes... Red sky at night, sailor take...
delight.
Delight. Which generally means... that in order to get the red skies, you need to have the sun, basically a clear path for the sun, so mm-hmm. there's no clouds there.
Yeah.
So it's red sky at night, the sun is to the west, sun is going down, so it means it's clear out there. And I think they recognize that weather systems in the mid-latitude move from west to east, so good weather's coming you. Whereas in red sky morning, sailors take warning, that means it's clear to the east, which means that clouds must be coming from the west.
Yeah, and they're looking red because the color of the sun is red early in the morning, and they're bounced off the clouds on the western horizon. Yeah, in a manner that was just like what we were talking about. Yeah.
So, what is there anything that we can surmise or not? Probably not. From all the rain we've got out in West Virginia, is it, where they've had all the flooding?
Yeah, they've had some nasty flooding there, and I guess they were predicting more rain
today.
Yeah, today again.
Yeah. It's not that unusual for certain kinds of weather systems, the kind that can deliver that kind of weather, to come by. They're extreme events. They do happen occasionally. So I don't know if there's anything particularly unusual about this set of circumstances, except that it doesn't happen that frequently. But the ingredients that go into it are really nothing out of the ordinary. It's just one of those things where you get a couple of these really impressive, I think this was one of those derecho events like they had in the D.C. area three or four summers ago. It was a really famous one. Marched across 1,000 kilometers or 1,000 miles of the country. This one here developed more in the Ohio River Valley and marched eastward across West Virginia. And West Virginia is a corrugated surface. It's a lot of mountains, and if you get 9 inches of rain in the valleys,
in
you're
going to
get 9 feet of rain. Is what it turns into.
Accumulate in the wrong place
very fast,
and very sad too, for that matter.
It's terrible.
What's our weather forecast for Wisconsin for summer? The rest of the summer is the long range
hot.
The
outlook was for above average temperatures by, and I think significantly above the probability mm-hmm. that you would normally expect the summer.
Yeah.
You were talking to 66%.
Yeah, and I'm still trying to figure out what's the reason behind that, because I'm sure that there's a good reason.
Trend. I think it's just, we've just been having hot, because these things
funny,
are statistical.
Yeah,
forecast,
right.
So
right.
We've just been having a hot period since the 2000s, right? Well, for a longer than
and
that.
And we've had... Well, we've had now 2 days or 3 days over 90, and I guess that a year that's above average in terms of heat would give us 15 to 20 such days, maybe more. A couple of years ago, we had 39, which was almost the record. That was exceptional. But if this is just going to be a warmer than average summer, maybe 15 or 20 of them or something.
Yeah.
So, but we're not close to that yet, so it means July and August might be really brutal.
Yeah.
excuse me for my forgetting to turn off my cell phone. I get these calls from Vista, California, and places like that in my show, and I never answer those.
Right.
I have no idea where those are coming from. And most of the time, I remember to turn my phone off, but this time I didn't. Oh, man. So the rest of the hot, probably, and the rest of the country the same way then?
Yeah,
they're still looking. The drought in the California area, they're still looking at that persisting. And some warmth in the southeast. I don't remember about precipitation-wise. But
you wonder about, I wonder sometimes about how these forecasts are put together, the long-range ones.
They're largely statistical.
Seat of the pants.
Yeah. Well, it's more than that, but it's not really in a completely different league. It's important to understand, I think, that the 1 to 2 to 3 to 5 day forecast that you see in the broadcast media, whether it's the radio or television or even in the newspapers to the extent that they're there, those are much more what we'd call deterministic forecasts. You're basing what you say about 5 days from now almost exclusively on the initial conditions from the prior evening run through our sophisticated forecast models that give a numerical answer, and then that numerical answer is interpreted based on the knowledge that the scientists interpreting it have of how the atmosphere works. So that's much more of a solid sort of this set of conditions leads to this event, whereas the whole seasonal forecasting thing is, as Steve was mentioning, it's much more statistical, it's much more trend-based. It's not that there's no science there. There's quite a bit of science. It's just a different kind of science. It's more of a statistical, statistically oriented approach to looking at the future as opposed to a deterministic approach.
Yeah, and so obviously the accuracy goes down.
Yeah.
But overall,
you try to paint the picture accurately, and you don't worry so much about the details. So when the answer comes out that it's going to be a warmer than normal summer, that's a lot of information. It doesn't tell you that July 15th, if you're having a picnic somewhere, it's going to be 98 degrees and you wish you didn't schedule it for that day. You're not going to get that kind of detail.
Dennison Appleton, thanks for calling.
Hi. I kind of hate to ask this question, but I'm wondering, on average, when can we expect the first frost? And also wondering, how is the wine in France?
How does the what? I'm sorry?
How is the wine in France?
Oh, how's the wine in France? Oh, okay.
Wine in France is very good. Everywhere we went. As was the food.
Well,
and the art. And the science conference I was at.
And I can't speak to that, Dennis.
I tell you what, I'm gonna let these guys ponder their wine and also the frost, and we'll get back to them. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests today, we're going to take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. So, great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller as we take a look at weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Great to have them along. Steve also directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. And you may have a weather question or maybe an experience to share. Join in, 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post a weather photo or question on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And we did have a question, right?
It was about frost. So in Dane County, the last spring frost on average occurs the end of April, beginning of May. And more up in the Appleton area where he is, that's like usually the first week of May, like between the 3rd and the 8th, I think. And what's interesting is that the time difference between the last spring frost and the first fall frost, so that's essentially the growing season, between 1950 and trending to 2010, that time period in Wisconsin has increased by 9 days.
Wow.
So you have a week-long growing season. That's what global warming has done.
Pretty unbelievable.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so what? So
and in some places,
So when is that? When is it now?
So now it's late April for Dane County, mostly late April, early May.
And then the first one in fall
It's in October, early October, I think.
Okay.
So you're only talking about a 5-month season anyway, 20 weeks.
Yeah.
And you're adding 5.8 8% or something like that to that season.
Yeah. I mean, it's
that's a lot.
It's incredible.
And, that's a
and
lot.
In places in the Southwest California, it's almost 3 weeks lengthening
wow.
of growing season.
Incredible.
Wow. It's just,
and I think the first snow is somewhere in mid-November, isn't it? In many
right.
of the counties
yeah.
in the state,
yeah.
somewhere like that, 10th to the 20th or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Ernest
wow.
in Vernon County has a different question.
Hello, gentlemen. Say, I'm curious about how the average temperature is calculated, whether it's used calculus or it's just the highest temperature of that day and the lowest temperature and averaged out.
Yes.
Because you will often hear where the warmest temperature was just after midnight and the temperature plummets 30 degrees or it can go either way. And, of course, if it's going to be your average temperature, say, is 84, well, you wake up in the 70s and it builds to 84. It might be 84 for, say, an hour, and then it starts on the curve down. So how is that calculated?
Yeah, that's a good question. I believe it's the simpler of the two
yeah.
formulas. Unfortunately, because there's really, in the age of digital recording devices, there's no reason why you couldn't use the mean value theorem and get a really nice picture of that. Perhaps it's just tradition that we haven't abandoned what has always been the way to do it. You record the maximum and the minimum for a given 24-hour period and average those together, and that's your average daily temperature. Even if you're watching the temperature drop at midnight from 15 to minus 5, whatever it is at midnight as the coldest temperature of the day, presumably on that day, that's the one you use for your minimum. So
wow.
it's a really good question. And it does give you the impression, if you're only looking at a 10-day window, you'd say, oh, man, this can't possibly tell me what happened over these 10 days. But if you have a 150-year record at thousands of observing stations, the errors that might accumulate because of that are going to be offset. They're going to offset each other. So you end up with probably a pretty good record, even though that method's a little bit funny.
Yeah.
Okay. Second thing, I posted a picture, I don't know if you gentlemen can see it or not, of that cloud formation. I called earlier with a viewing a cloud formation where there was a rain line, not a rainbow.
Yeah.
This cloud formation was pushing these whiskey clouds in front of it. And on our way to Spring Green for the art show, coming from Vernon County down or over, we were able to observe it again. And I shared a photo on the Larry Mueller Show.
And we have it. Thank you so much for sharing that. And we have it up right now on our Facebook page.
Yeah, you got to go look at that. That is so cool.
That's a great picture. Yeah.
It's amazing. The one that I had seen, each individual finger that was coming down was a different color. Yesterday, they ran horizontally, no curve to it. It was in the line of the cloud formation pushing it.
Mm.
And we were very lucky to catch a picture of it. But as we were walking around the show at Spring Green, many people looked up and observed the interesting cloud formation.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Very good.
There's a couple of things going on in
yeah.
there. One is that, you know, the clouds themselves are liquid water clouds.
Yeah, stratocumulus.
Probably stratocumulus
yeah.
type, or maybe an altocumulus.
Yeah.
And then the wispy things that fall below them, at some point, those water droplets are super cooled, so they're below freezing, but they maintain a liquid water structure. But that at some point they freeze and they become an ice crystal, and then they grow really quickly and they fall out of the cloud. And that's that wispy streak.
Mm.
And the sun's just in the right position that you're getting that it's not a rainbow, it's more of a halo type
feature
down below.
Right. And the striations in the stratocumulus make me think that they almost got penetrated by aircraft, because if aircraft go through such clouds, the propellants from the engines can seed those little water droplets in the supercooled clouds and produce these fall streaks of ice, as Steve was just talking about. This isn't obvious that happened, but it's suggestive that it almost did in a couple of those places where the clouds go bald a little bit.
Yeah, you
really
got a great photo there, Ernest.
Photo.
Yeah, thank you very much. Boy, because the last time I called, it's like, oh, this guy's been smoking something.
Well, I was going to ask you, was this before or after the art fair?
and to actually get a photo of it was like, thank you, God. Thank you so much.
That's pretty awesome.
It's
yeah.
real.
Setting the record straight. As far as contrails, and I'm observant of this. I saw none. I saw yesterday was, of course, this is a very high sky.
Yeah,
but
right.
I did not. and I look up a lot, I did not see moisture that high. But, of course, you couldn't see aircraft through this cloud formation.
Yeah. And when they actually do really penetrate that cloud deck, they leave a gaping hole. This is an absolute bald spot. And your picture, of course, doesn't have that. It has these little striations. They may be just circulation anomalies in the cloud field. But they have a exactly some sort of wave which has local maxima in its intensity, but it's a little bit suggestive. But as you're pointing out, as we're discussing it, it's probably not the case that this had anything to do with propellants from airplanes.
Okay, all right. Very good. And why don't you guys set up a program and calculate the average daily temperature and see if you can't get some other people interested in trying that and compare the two.
It would be an interesting thing to do, and not that hard to do. Very easy
to do that. Grad students sitting around with nothing to do this summer.
You just need to have the data stream. Then it would be a cinch to do that. Yeah. So it'd be really interesting.
Thanks, Ernest. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call, and thanks so much for the photo. It's definitely a wonderful shot. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and take a look at it. Eric in Beloit, we'll turn to you. Hi, Eric.
Good afternoon. I know that there's a tremendous amount of science involved in predicting the weather, and without disparaging our colleagues in the journalism, I was wondering how much does your local weather person actually contribute to a weather forecast? Is there a lot of variation on a local level that they can do, or are they largely just taking the information that they get and providing it? I'm really curious.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there are times where you can see that there's an obvious value added at the location of the broadcast station. I think the times where that's most obvious to me are times when there's convective weather in the area and they're looking at their own radar and zooming in on locations. You really won't get that kind of detailed discussion of the impact and likely arrival time of those kind of weather events except by the local broadcasters. And so that's a definite value added, science value added to the discussion. I think the same thing happens with forecasts of an intense snow in the wintertime. There can often be a little bit of discrepancy between what the local person is saying and what you're getting from the weather service, which has a broader purview of several counties, let's say, in the southern part of the state, as opposed to the Dane County, central Dane County viewing area for Madison. And so I think one gets the sense, perhaps I have a better sense of it myself because I know I'm seeing the differences, that there really is value added by science information at the local broadcast level. And I suspect that occurs every single day just because it makes the job interesting. Otherwise, if all you're doing is reporting what somebody else says, I think you lose a sense of the excitement that the weather has engendered in the people who end up being weather professionals. So.
And I think just to a nod to at least Madison, we have a really good group across the stations of meteorologists.
Yeah, I think probably all of them are trained as meteorologists and not as science communicators, though they do have good science communication skills for
sure. Right, they do.
And I totally agree that it's when you have weather event that's occurring that you really need them.
Absolutely.
Today, in southern Wisconsin, if it's, a high of 88 or 89, who really cares, right? Yeah.
But if there's a bad weather
moving into the area.
Right. Something like that, turn to your local weather person for sure.
Right.
Well, Charles from Green Bay called to ask, what makes a storm an electrical storm? How much thunder and lightning must there be? Like we had
just one thunder or one lightning bolt and you're electrical storm.
I think so, yeah.
That's the definition of a thunderstorm,
right? Yeah, just minimal threshold.
Right. It occurred.
And why, Saturday night, for example, I didn't go to the Rhythm and Booms or whatever it's called now, but it wasn't long between the end of the.
It was minutes, wasn't it?
Right, before you got the real show.
Yeah. And then the real show started, and there was a lot of thunder and lightning.
Yeah, that was a very dramatic event. That one was tied to a very unusually well organized weather system in southern Canada. Kind of progressed past our longitude, and in the trailing cold front organized a really nice line of thunderstorms, more than one line, actually. It was a successive set of lines, but within each one, a lot of thunder and lightning because it was nicely organized precipitation. Sometimes you get, as Steve points out, it's true, you get an electrical storm, even if you get one lightning strike and one thunderclap, but usually they come in a congregation of several different storms, and sometimes more storms than others, and you get really vivid displays. But these ones that come along, an organized cold front in June, they're a treat because it's a rare type of structure, and they really light up. They're just beautiful. It was a great night.
And you need that vigorous storm to get those.
That's right.
And the 2 inches of rain that we got in southern Wisconsin was much needed. And it was great. Storms in the north were much more harder, let's say.
Yeah, that was true the weekend before, too. Yeah, that was true also.
Well, speaking of storms, Diane from Sparta emailed in to ask, what's the difference between stray and scattered thunderstorms? Is there a difference?
I've never heard of the term stray thunderstorms. I guess it probably means there's just one or two that'll pop up somewhere.
Yeah, that's what I would interpret it as, too, where scatters is probably, you know, it's like in, I would say, in Hawaii or in Florida, scattered thunderstorms, you know, they're occurring all over the place, and they're not generally severe.
But they're not all in one.
Right.
Yeah, and you also know they're going to happen somewhere.
You know they're going to happen.
Maybe the stray is meant to imply there's some chance that there'll be one somewhere, but we don't really have great confidence that there will be or something
Like
that.
Maybe moving into the area or something.
Ken from Little Chute posted on Facebook to ask if it's possible to predict if there will be a colorful sunset by late afternoon.
You know, there probably is, and I've actually thought about this now and then. You know, what would the ingredients go into doing that, particularly in resort areas along beaches and things like that? And I think it would be a pretty tough forecast because you'd have to forecast cloud conditions, where they are.
At a very detailed level.
At a very detailed
precise
level.
Time.
Yeah, and one of the toughest forecasts we have is precipitation.
Yeah. Right?
Precipitation is tied to clouds.
Yeah.
So it would be a challenge to do, but...
Might be one of those.
Be fun for resort areas.
Yeah, you know, it might be one of those things where the first half of the problem wouldn't be so hard to do, which is forecast the days where you know you're not going to get a good sunset. Cross them off the calendar.
Yeah.
And then
That's
say, you know, if you have a 7-day period where you're on vacation and somebody tells you Monday and Tuesday, forget it. It's going to be a disaster for a variety of reasons. You don't have to articulate them. And then you could say, be on alert for Wednesday through Friday, though. That could be.
Because we'll have the high Sirius moving in.
Yeah,
and
right.
The colors,
You might be able to do it that way as opposed to prescribing the perfect conditions, eliminate the worst ones.
Right,
That's a good way to look at it. Mm-hmm. I like that. Amy in Milwaukee has something for us. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I was wondering, when it says that there's a 35% chance of rain, does that mean that no matter where you are in that area, that there's a chance that you'll have rain 35%, or that 35% of the area will receive rain at that time?
It could be either one. I'm going to say
who's saying it.
Or do they mean the same thing? Are they the same thing?
They're not actually the same thing. You draw a really good distinction, Amy. They're not the same thing. I think what's become more commonly the case, and certainly it's the way that I have this in my head when I'm telling somebody who might ask me about the weather on the coming day, I might say the latter. I might say, you know, there's about a 50% chance if you're anywhere in Dane County, you're going to see a thunderstorm. It doesn't mean that at any given location, you got a 50% chance of staying in a thunderstorm. It's a little bit different than that. So I don't know what the term of art actually means from one forecast to the next, and if there is a standard. I'm not sure there's a standard. But it gets to the point where it almost starts to sound like the same thing, but I don't think it is quite the same thing. And I always like to use it as a probability statement for a given area.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Pete from La Crosse emailed us, this is about red sky at night, sailor's delight. He said this is used by mid-latitude sailors, 30 to 60 degrees north, looking away from the setting or rising sun. Red sky at night means the storms are east of the boat, and red sky in the morning means that the storms are west of the boat.
Yeah, and since they're moving west to east, the morning, the red sky in the morning is not something you like to see.
Right. Yeah.
Well, he, just to move on to something else, I wanted to get to the Great Lakes a bit.
Yeah.
The water levels on the Great Lakes...
Above average now.
Above average.
Well, good.
Yep.
Good.
They've been above average since roughly 2014,
I think. Cold winter.
Yeah.
Put ice on them. Isn't that amazing? For years we've been talking about this.
Well, it's been ice and snow, and during that particular year, too, it was the ice year coupled by precipitation into the area.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the ice prevents the evaporation in the wintertime.
Right. Yeah. And then you pile up a little bit of extra that runs off, and so you get a double whammy. That's pretty
good. But, we were below normal since, like, 98 up until 2014.
I know.
Then they caught up.
Year after year.
Yeah.
Is this a kind of a normal pattern that, or an anomaly? Or
I wonder about that. I don't know.
I don't think we know enough about the water budget of the Great Lakes to figure that out.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been doing this for a long, long time, and I you know, 30 years ago, I can, you know, we were talking about how low the water levels were.
But and, then there was a time period when it was way too high.
It was way too high. And it's gone back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah. You know, in our 20 years together, the thing that's struck me, and it's recent, as you point out, Steve, is the incredible influence the ice has.
Yeah.
If you put 95% ice coverage on these lakes, that's it. That solves your problem, almost no matter how desperate it was to begin with. That's amazing.
Well, evaporation is a function of the difference between the water temperature and the air temperature, right?
So and
you put the ice on there.
If there's nothing permeable, you can't do anything.
Right.
It's amazing. Yeah. Just amazing.
And other than look out at your pier to see how much water is around it, where does the water level information come from? Is there...
There are gauges that measure the water height. I get it from the Great Lakes Research something.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. I don't know what it stands for either.
Yeah.
There's a National Data Buoy Center, too, that has buoys on Lake Michigan, all the lakes. I don't know if they record level. And then the USGS must have information on that,
I think
too,
the site that I'm going to, I think, is a NOAA site that monitors the Great Lakes water level. But, yeah, USGS does the local the inland water levels as well, like on ours. I was just trying to find that actually the other day, because it seems like Lake Mendota is a little bit above normal to me. Just as a guy goes on the lake, looks at my dock. Well, he goes, it's going underwater pretty soon.
2 inches of rain Saturday night, doesn't it?
That's going to help.
I mean, it really does put it up.
Well, is there a great importance to keeping these? Obviously, the Great Lakes, they keep these records, I suppose. Maybe for shipping in some part.
I think it's important for shipping, and I think as we look, we know that the climate is changing in terms of weather, and so as we get better and better at looking out further and further, you know, we need to know what the water budgets of the lakes are in order to be able to maintain them for recreation and for economics of the region.
Yeah, it's a big resource. There's a lot of people who need water, and the Great Lakes do a great job in providing that, you know, essential resource. So we do, we got to keep straight what we have in the bank.
And I want to go back to your comment earlier about how we have 9 more days.
Longer, the growing season is increased by 9 days. And that's counted from the last spring frost, the time period starting then, to the first fall frost.
Is 9 days long?
9 days longer than it was in 1950. Yeah, in the 1950s.
So doing the math on that, looking ahead another 20 years.
We will always have a winter in Wisconsin, but the growing season's going to get longer. It's just, that's what happens when you warm up.
So if your tomatoes are no good, it's your fault.
That's right.
It's not that you had a shorter growing season.
Well, and also I was saying to John earlier that we went on a tour with the Wisconsin Teachers of Local Culture. I tagged along on that. And one of the things I saw, this was up by Eau Claire, and there is a trend towards some of the younger farmers, at least in that area, we're using more and more hoop houses. And that does two things. One is it controls pests, but it also increases the growing degree days because it keeps you warmer at night.
How do you like that?
And so they're kind of doing local microclimate change by growing their vegetation in there. And I'm sure there's going to be a key point where, if your growing season is so short, adding that may not help, but as you get to that point where, you know, you have enough growing degree days to grow a tomato, that all of a sudden if you increase that by 1 day, you could actually get a lot of tomatoes.
Yeah, so, you compete against markets that come from warmer
climates. Right, if you're on that transition zone.
Yeah,
that transition zone is probably going to be moving north.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was something I was thinking of when I was talking to one of those farmers. I was like, wow, that's really interesting. And it was the younger farmers that were doing it, which also made it interesting.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Well, it's always interesting having you guys. In the short run, we're going to have across Wisconsin summer weather.
Beautiful summer weather.
Week this week,
beautiful
like.
Summer. Right. Go outside and watch those yellow, orange sunsets.
And stop counting down because the days are getting shorter.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, we're heading towards fall, even though it's going to be getting hotter.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess I'll invite you guys back. July 25th is the last Monday.
July 25th. Right.
All right.
25th. We'll have you back. Thanks again, guys.
All right. Thank you, Larry.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison, our guests. We'll have them back the last Monday of July, and we'll do this all over again. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the Mississippi River with the editor of Big River Magazine, among other things, so I hope you'll join us for that. In the meantime, thanks a lot for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.